Association, James J. Knightley, Appellant Counsel, Barry Doran, Appellate Counsel.
You may proceed.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, my name is James Knightley. I am the attorney for the appellants Stephen and Marta DeBartik in this case. Your Honors, this case is a pristine case of statutory interpretation involving a 2008 amendment to the Powhatan Village Homeowners Association Declaration that failed to meet specific requirements of Virginia Code 55, 515.1, subsection F. The effect of the amendment was to strip away from my clients their right to rent their property in a subdivision of over 200 residential lots. When they purchased the property, they had the right to rent it. A few years later, they discovered that that right had been extinguished, in effect, by the recordation of that amendment. When they sought to challenge the validity of the amendment, the Circuit Court determined that the one-year statute of limitations or limitations period in subsection E prevented and proposed a time bar for their bringing the case. Your Honor, I think the first starting point here is the plain meaning of the statute. That's both the standard of review. This court has also recognized it in the Benoni case, which is another homeowners association case a few years ago. And looking at the statute in that light, particularly subsection F, we see important requirements when amendments are made to homeowner declarations. First of all, it requires that an amendment be signed or executed by the two-thirds or the requisite majority of homeowners, and the wording there is mandatory, shall be signed. Secondly, the statute says the amendment shall be effective if a copy of the amendment is recorded together with a certification that is signed by a principal officer or other designated officer of the association that the requisite majority of the owners signed the amendment or signed ratifications of the amendment. A very clear predicate requirement using the word effective, which also appears in subsection E, which is at the time bar. The 2008 amendment had a fatal defect in this regard. That amendment certifies only that there was a vote, and it only certifies that there was a meeting, and that the results of the meeting and the vote are on file, but there's nothing whatsoever about signatures to any amendment or signatures to any ratifications of the amendment. Your Honors, under subsection F, the amendment was not effective, and under subsection E, the time bar did not start until the amendment was effective.
May I ask you this? Your opponent says the literal reading that you're advocating stresses out the absurdity canon. How do you best address that?
Well, Your Honors, the way I address it is, and of course they cited a couple of cases, the Burns case and the Westminster case, indicating that on statute of limitations this court imposes a strict interpretation. However, there is an important statement that was made by the court with regard to that, and that is, I think in both cases, in light of the policy surrounding statutes of limitations, and I'm quoting from the opinions in those cases, the bar of the statutes should not be lifted unless the legislature makes unmistakably clear that such is to occur in a given case. And here the General Assembly specified strict criteria for an amendment to be effective. And it seems to me that a strict interpretation of the statute, either from the perspective of restrictive covenants or even in light of statutes of limitations, that those criteria established by the General Assembly as to when an amendment becomes effective should apply as well to the statute of the time bar in subsection E. Now, with regard to whether something is absurd or not, this is a legislative construct of a statute and directing when the time bar begins. And it seems to me that is worthy of consideration and regard to this court under those criteria. There are other situations where statutes of limitations are unlimited. For example, in restrictive covenants generally, the common law of restrictive covenants, You can bring, there's no statute of limitations on enforcement of those, and there are specific criteria, and this would be non-property owner association covenants. There's no, you have horizontal privity and vertical privity and 100% consent under the decisions of this court, and that's forever, effectively. In addition, fraudulent conveyances of property, that there's no limit on that. And there's a case, I didn't cite it in the brief, but I think it's a case of Fluke versus Armantrout, 100 Virginia 638, where the court has indicated, and it's been indicated in a circuit court opinion recently, 2053 Virginia Circuit 16, where the court said there's basically an unlimited period, no statute of limitations with regard to fraudulent conveyances of real property. And of course, we have all of the other different statutes of limitations that the General Assembly has enacted in 8.1, 249, 229, 243, involving different triggering events, subsequent events, tollings of statutes of limitations with regard to infancy, capacity, fraud, mistake, occupational disease, sex abuse.
Would latches ever be a fallback?
Well, it might conceivably, but I think the standard for latches is very, very high, and I don't think we have that in this case.
But my point is, wouldn't latches mitigate the absurdity point? It's not absurd because there is, in fact, a legal doctrine or an equitable doctrine.
Absolutely. Latches would be a potential fallback position for something where the court has recognized in some cases unscrupulous plaintiffs might have attempted to take advantage of it, you know, an extensive period of time, certainly. But I don't think that applies in this case. Your Honors, the Homeowners Association, I would say I would like to reserve a couple of minutes of my time, but regardless of that, Your Honors, the Homeowners Association seems to say, well, let's just look at subsection E and effective means, recordation. But if you look at the Condominium Act, and this court has, in the Zanoni case, said we look at these other acts to see how these things work. In that case, the time bar, almost an identical statute for condominiums, says 1 year from recordation. Not from the effective date of the amendment, but from recordation. And, of course, in our case, the subsection E uses the word effective. There's decisions of this court, including Zanoni, which say we presume the General Assembly knew the difference between the two words when it enacted these statutes. Your Honors, the interpretation of the Homeowners Association violates at least four principles of statutory construction here. Plain meaning, of course, we talked about. You look at the statute of the whole and you harmonize the provisions of the statute as a whole. We have the tradition of strict construction of restrictive covenants as well as statutes of limitations and the criteria for those. And finally, if you simply look at subsection E and say it doesn't mean effective, then the word effective in subsection S has no meaning, in subsection F, has no meaning whatsoever. It's meaningless. There's no purpose for it. If you look at the legislative summary, which we've quoted in the brief, the legislative summary separates out the two sections. And it says the bill provides, and this is as passed, one, an action to challenge may be brought no more than 1 year after the amendment is effective, and then two, it provides when an amendment is effective. The common denominator there in the description of what the legislation was intended to do is effective. In addition, Your Honor, I do want to point out the history and common law tradition here, which the court recognized in the Dogwood Valley Citizens Association case. In that case, interpreting filings purporting to amend a declaration, the court said a declaration is a document that can be changed only if the lot owners have noticed and agree to the change, see Code Section 55-515.1. And this is quoting again from the court, a condition consistent with the method of altering restrictive covenants applicable to real property, and citing the Henning versus Mader case, in that case, interpreting the common law provisions which required 100% consent. Your Honors, we have here a legislative modification of the common law rule, which sets forth, relaxes that common law rule with regard to subdivisions covered by property owners association documents, which substitutes for 100% to the requisite majority, but they still want signatures on the amendment or the ratifications. And secondly, then, a certification that that has actually transpired. And by the way, the signatures don't have to be notarized as they would if you had 100% of owners where you recorded. That's relaxed too. But you want a certification that the signature and the amendment was signed by the requisite majority of the homeowners. That did not occur, obviously, in this case. Now, the HOA says, well, this certification is adequate. It cites the statute. It says there's evidence on file. Even on page 5 of the brief, they seem to be suggesting there were signed ratifications, which there's none whatsoever in the record. Your Honors, I think it's pretty obvious that the certification only talks about a vote. It only talks about the results of a meeting, and there's nothing in the record about signatures. Your Honors, I will reserve the rest of my time.
All right. Thank you very much, Mr. Nason.
Good morning, and may it please the Court. My name is Barry Dorans. I'm here on behalf of the Association. Without waiving any arguments in our brief, I want to focus on a few factors. First, the plaintiffs own the lot since 2006. The amendment that they question was recorded with the certification in December of 2008. There's no explanation for why the homeowners didn't file a challenge then, which they could have, or within a year, as the statute permitted.
Say that again.
There is no explanation in record as to why
Why do they have to do that? Why do they have to explain it? Because the burden is on you to get it correct so that that period starts to run. Why does he have to explain?
It's our position.
If you had a latches claim, he'd have to explain. But why does he have to explain when it's a statute of limitations?
It's our position that the certification, and there is a certification with the amendment, and that certainly puts somebody on notice that something's been recorded with a certification. If he was unhappy with the certification, the time to bring the challenge was then. That's our reading of F and E. That is, E says you have a year if you're not happy from the date it's been recorded and become effective.
No, it's not recorded, it's effective.
Effective, correct. Recorded and effective.
Recorded is not in there.
Recorded is not effective. It has to be effective. I apologize, Your Honor. I misspoke. It's our position that effective is, what is the effective? What is the plain meaning of the word effective? And it is recorded with a certification. I don't know what more could be done to make it effective. That is
if the document itself is not effective, the recordation doesn't make it so.
I don't know that I follow the court's... In other words, once it's recorded, people would treat it as being in effect.
Well, they may very well, but if it's not, it's not.
I think it goes into effect until the court then finds it's invalid. And that's the position we take. That is to say, it's recorded, it's in effect. A court would then could come in and say, it's invalid. No, it's no longer of effect. But people buy and sell based on what's of record. And we believe that's the whole purpose of F and E. E says, here's the one-year limit. Make a challenge. If you don't, people will assume this is in effect.
You had a deed that was not notarized, but that the clerk had not noticed that and had recorded it. Would that deed be effective?
Your Honor, that's a very good question. I do not know. I assume it would not be effective.
Okay. Because the statutory requirements have not been met prior to recordation.
Correct.
And it would not be a matter where the deed was effective until somebody challenged it and a court entered an order. It would have been ineffective ab initio, correct?
I would agree with that, yes, Your Honor.
Okay, how is that any different from what you
Because doing? This particular document does have a certification. If there was no certification, they might have a good claim to say there's no certification. But the statute doesn't say on F, the certification must have these magic words. So, for example,
it has to have a magic percentage.
I don't know that. I heard the
It has
court.
To have a certain percentage.
It has to have a certain percentage, and I'll point out that one of their challenges is that the certification doesn't say requisite majority, even though the statute says the majority is two-thirds, and the certification said two-thirds. But the certification didn't say requisite majority. Well, clearly we've complied with requisite majority when we hit the two-thirds. We don't have to use the words requisite majority. Secondly, when we look at F, it says agreement of the required majority of lot owners shall be evidenced by either their execution of the amendment or ratifications, and it doesn't describe what a ratification is other than it's some evidence. And when we look at the certification, it says, I have evidence on file that these people voted. And it's our position that is...
But it's not simply that they voted. It is that the requisite majority, two-thirds, signed the amendment or ratification, and the certification doesn't say that.
The certification doesn't say ratifications. It says I have evidence on file they voted. And it doesn't describe a ratification.
Well, can't you vote for something and not sign the amendment or the ratification?
You could, but there would be would not necessarily be evidence. It's our position that when it says I have evidence on file and evidence of a vote, and if it's I had a ballot and I signed my ballot and I maintained that evidence is a ratification.
Well, that's can't what evidence be I saw the person raise his hand and two-thirds in the room raise their hand and say, let's go along with this.
That could be as well. It's our position, though, that the statute doesn't require the specific words ratification or amendment. And that the certification on its face purports to comply with the statute because it says I have evidence on file.
Well, the certification has to include a certain subject. You're certifying something. There's no such thing as a certification in the abstract. You're always certifying something. You're saying something. And then it tells us what has to be said, and it wasn't said. I know this may sound oversimplistic, but why don't we just read it the way it's written and let the policy arguments be addressed in other forms?
Judge, I guess the question is, the certification didn't say that you required the requisite majority. It didn't say that. On the other hand, it's clear from it that two-thirds voted. That doesn't make it invalid, and that doesn't mean that the 1 year hasn't run.
Well, let me make sure I'm not misreading this. The certification must certify, quote, that the requisite majority of the lot owners sign the amendment or ratifications. Well, did your certification certify that?
It is our position it did. And so our position says that two-thirds, which turns out to be the requisite majority, that is to say you can tell that from the statute and from the documents, that two-thirds is the requisite majority. And then it says signed ratifications, and the question is, what's a signed ratification? A signed ratification, as you see earlier in F, is evidence of their vote. It then says, I have evidence by the results of the meeting, such evidence is on file. So in other words, there's evidence on file with the association. So if you're not happy with the evidence we're on file, bring suit, challenge it, we'll show the evidence. That's our reading of the statute.
Mr. Dorans, you argue that the interpretation that Mr. Nicely places on this would result in a manifest absurdity. Now, is that a colloquial absurdity or is that a legal absurdity?
I would say
there is a difference.
I would say a colloquial absurdity. That is to say, his position is, if we recorded it with the correct certification, his time to challenge whether the certification was correct was once we recorded it with a correct certification. And that colloquially is absurd.
Well, okay, then you realize that if that's the case, the manifest absurdity rule does not apply.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. Well, I just want to make sure and make it clear, because there are lots of things that if I had the ability to change, I would, because I don't think it makes any sense. But a legal absurdity means you can't do it.
It is not legally impossible. What we're pointing out is that the court found, and really the issue, in our opinion, is whether there are magic words that are required in certification or not. The trial court found that this certification complied with F, and that's all it needed. That started the 1 year.
And so many lawyers that come up here and don't know the difference. I'm really pleased that you do.
In doing the research, it's clear that a legal absurdity is something that's impossible of occurring, and clearly this is possible of occurring.
Good.
I would point out one other point. There is some argument on the other side that in restrictive covenants, the court uses a strict construction. Every case I've seen talks about in interpreting the covenant itself, not in determining whether it is valid, that is to say, the method of amending. I'm not aware of any such thing that would require that you have to hit, as we had in the same thing, magic words. It's our position that we have an amendment, we have a certificate that says I've complied with it, we reference the code section. That starts the 1 year. It's time to go forward. Thank you.
All right, thank you very much. Mr. Nicely, you have 4 minutes and 39 seconds left.
Your Honors, I don't want to take any more of the court's time from the questions. It appears to me that there seems to be a very comprehensive understanding of the issues in the case. I would say, Your Honor, that we're dealing here with property rights, with the rights of owners, rights when they purchase property to expect that what they acquired will be in effect unless processes are duly followed to extinguish those rights, which in our opinion, Your Honors, there wasn't. Now, we've heard talk today here about ratifications, and I think it's pretty clear that although Mr. Dorn has worked hard to suggest that any sort of signature of an owner is a ratification. I think the dictionary definition of ratification says that you sign something, you sign a ratification after something has happened. Typically, in a lot of these associations, there's a vote, and there may be a vote. But after a ratification is approving something that happened previously. And here, there's no record of anything, any signatures on an amendment, any signatures on a ratification. All we know that there was some sort of vote. We don't know what that vote was. And, of course, Your Honors, this affects not just this homeowners association. This affects important property rights for many myriad of homeowners associations throughout the Commonwealth dealing with residential property. And it seems to me where there has been a very strong common law tradition that people don't alienate their property rights without their knowledge of it, that here we don't even have any suggestion in the record or otherwise that there anybody signed anything or whether it was in the amendment itself or the ratifications. So, Your Honors, I would request that the court reverse the circuit court and remand this to the trial court. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Call the next case.